Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. Today, we address a couple themes, one historical and the other theoretical, that crop up repeatedly on our show. Those two themes, respectively, are religion and the American founding, our empirical focus today, and the economics of religion, a theoretical perspective that your lovable host is known for, and from which a number of our guests on this podcast also ascribe to, including Dan Hungerman, Ellie Berman, Mark Vanderer, Timur Curran, Jared Rubin, and last week's guest, Sean Everton. My interest in addressing these empirical and theoretical themes, and our focus will be mostly theoretical today, stems from a paper that came across my desk about a year ago entitled The Free Market and the Founder's Approach to Church-State Relations, written by today's guest, Professor Chris Beneke. While the title of the paper caught my attention, I will admit that I found it to be a challenging piece in that it cast a bit of suspicion on the use of economics to understand religious behavior. And so I wrestled with the paper a bit, let it sit on my desk for a while, but had always intended to contact the author to talk about his argument. It finally took the author to friend me on Facebook and taught me about my fantasy football picks before I decided to ring him up for an interview. And so, without any further delay, I introduce Chris Beneke, an associate professor of history at Bentley University in Waltham, Massachusetts, where he also serves as the director of the Valenti Center for Arts and Sciences. Chris has written numerous articles on religion and the American founding, including two books, Beyond Toleration, The Religious Origins of American Pluralism, and The First Prejudice, Religious Tolerance and Intolerance in Early America, the latter which was co-edited with Chris Grenada. We will link to both of those books on our websites, where you can also find a space to comment on today's interview, and if you are technologically wired to a large social network, you can recommend us to your friends on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, or any other doohickey like that. Now, of course, if you are not so technologically inclined, you can always write the address of our website, www.researchonreligion.org, on a sheet of paper with red crayon and tape it to your neighbor's front window to let them know what we're up to. That should catch their attention. So, Chris, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks, Tony. It's a pleasure to be here.
I got to cut right to the chase here. You're a Boston Red Sox fan, but it is football season, and we're just on the verge of the NFL playoffs, and you've been chortling all fall about my loyalty to the San Diego Chargers. So, are your cherished New England Patriots going to be the AFC representative in the Super Bowl this year?
Well, first, Tony, let me correct the misapprehension there. First of all, I've really only been twirling about your selection of Philip Rivers, quarterback of your fantasy team, on the weeks in which he doesn't perform well at all. But I do know the Chargers still have a chance to make the playoffs.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Patriots are probably going to make their way to the Super Bowl. How they'll do against NFC teams is another matter.
Okay. Well, we'll see. And maybe Tom Brady can end up dating Madonna during halftime or something. I don't know. All right. Let's cut to the other chase now and put football aside for a minute and start talking about your article that I mentioned in our introduction, which was entitled The Free Market and the Founder's Approach to Church-State Relations. In this publication, which came out with the Journal of Church and State, which I should mention is published by the Baylor University or is published at Baylor University, you provide a critique of what you term, quote, an alluring metaphor endowed with coherence, broad public recognition, and modern credentials. That alluring metaphor is the free market of religion, unquote. So I want to go ahead and deconstruct that passage a bit, starting with what you mean by the free market of religion. That phrase is really central to your article, so please explain what that means and why you chose to write a paper on that phrase.
That's a good question. I had written a review maybe 7 or 8 years ago of a book by a distinguished historian from Purdue named Frank Lambert called Religion and the Founding Fathers. And it was something along the lines of the place of religion in the founding. And my critique was, I think, sort of a knee-jerk historical reaction. And it's one I probably would have shared with a lot of other religious historians and theologians. And I rejected the idea that the founders, in fact, intended to create a free market of faith. But as I looked into the subject over time, I didn't surrender that position, but it became much more nuanced to me, this question of whether the founders intended to create a free market and whether they did actually create a free market of faith. But nonetheless, I thought the metaphor was being used way too loosely, both by scholars and by journalists. And I was guilty of the same, both in class and outside of it. In describing the founding to people, I very often resorted to the language of the free market of religion. So I wanted to subject it to a more rigorous interrogation.
Now, I want to stop you right there, because you said something really interesting. You said you wanted to examine whether the founders intended to create a free market of faith and whether one resulted. Now, I want to come back to that theme, but I want to mention this at the first, because this is something I picked up in the article, the issue of the founders' intention. And your paper makes the argument that the founders probably did not set out to say, let's create a free market of religion. I think you make a good case on that, and we'll explore that as the podcast interview goes along here. But there's a big difference between the intention of what they want to do and then the outcome of actually what happens.
Right, that's absolutely right. And I would agree that something like a free market of faith emerges by the 19th century in America, in which you have, and I'm describing this in loose historical terms, you have various groups, a lot of groups, in fact, competing for the attention of what could be described as religious consumers. I don't think that's a really misleading description of what happened in the early 19th century, but I don't think that that's what the founders intended.
Yeah, and you talk about the phrase free market of religion. I want to explore that further here. In two separate ways in the paper, you refer to some folks who use it in a casual sense, and I think this would include Frank Lambert or maybe some folks who use it in Time or Newsweek when they're casually writing. And then there's scholars who deliberately use economic or what we sometimes call rational choice theory to study religion. And is there a distinction between those two?
There is a distinction, although I think that historians who use the term free market religion are directly or indirectly drawing on rational choice theory. And so in this, you can tell me a lot better than I could tell you, but this approach assumes that religion can be approached a lot like other types of household commodities, like meals or laundry or relaxation and love, that scarcity plays an important role. And this is a good tool generally for sort of discerning how people make decisions, what they value, what they do not value. And how different organizations relate to one another. I mean, I'm sure there are shortfalls, but I'm not equipped to critique it. So I think that there is validity in the theory, which, by the way, also happens to account for why we've had more religion in the United States over the past two centuries than other parts of the world that have experienced similar levels of development.
Yeah, let's come back to that point here. I want to press you a little bit more on the issue. You made another interesting statement that said, you know, a lot of historians use the rational choice perspective. And I think in many ways it's implicitly, because when it comes down to it, when people start talking about the interest of how people pursue their interests throughout history, they, for at least from my perspective, they tend to fall into what we would consider a rational choice approach. Now, rational choice formalizes it a little bit more, use a little bit more technological economic jargon in that, but you know, even the scholars that say, oh, I don't do rational choice religion, still end up telling historical stories about this person wanted to achieve this goal. They wanted to conquer that nation. They wanted to enrich themselves this way, and this is how they go about doing it. And I think that could be encapsulated somewhat into that kind of perspective. What are your thoughts on that?
I think so. Yeah, I mean, I think there are plenty of uses for historians of rational choice theory. I just think that it has to be used carefully and supplemented by other, traditionally historical perspectives on how people go about making decisions and on what they value.
Yeah,
I think there's a stickiness to beliefs in particular and to associations that rational choice theory can't always account for. And I think when it comes to intentions with regard to major pieces of legislation, for instance, I think that also the rational choice theory isn't all that helpful.
Yeah, the rational choice theory tends to leave out what people prefer. We don't talk very much about why people prefer this thing, pursue that thing, etc. And that, you know, there's the realm of culture and of psychology or other things like that. One of the other things, and I want to keep coming back to this phrase, free market of religion here, that you focus on, is that when it comes to folks like me who do the rational choice or economic perspective on religion, I wouldn't necessarily say that I'm using the term free market of religion to talk about that specific historical epoch or era in the United States known as the colonial period or the 18th century or the founding era, because it seems to me that there was still a great deal of restrictions on the pursuit of religious activity. And this is true even after the First Amendment. So, that term free market of religion, I would tend to change that and say it's really a market of religion, one that can be regulated to various degrees there.
Yeah, that seems to me about right. It's not an unconstrained market by any chance.
Right.
And not just on the personal level, where people are constrained by family choices, for instance, or traditional obligations, but also on the macro level, where there are restrictions in Massachusetts, for instance, until the early 1830s on what people could do with their church funding. So this is not something that goes away in 1787 or 1791. It's something that does stick around, these restrictions on the market, or if you want to call that a religion. Yes, I think that's right. Is that a more nuanced approach than one which just says what we have is a free market religion is probably one that's called for.
Yeah, and it does bring up a huge, I think, misconception in how we examine the colonial period and the era around the founding, that it was unabated freedom for all, that there were folks that were all for breaking off with England and reducing taxation and creating other realms of economic freedom, but yet we're still very hesitant to do that in terms of the religious landscape. It's, oh no, if you disestablish congregationalism here in Massachusetts or Vermont, all hell's going to break loose, and so we better not do that. So there seemed to be, at least at that time, a lot of restrictions on religion, as one could argue are still today.
Yeah, I think people were more inclined to accept the free market in goods and services well before they were inclined to accept it in matters of religious faith. And I think that speaks to the difference between religious goods and other types of goods, if we want to call them this. And that is, religious goods are things that simply cannot, as John Locke and Thomas Jefferson both put it, be made up to you. Those are things that have eternal, transcendent meaning, and people are not willing to exchange them as they would other types of goods. So even as people were adopting the free market in their economic lives in the 1760s and 1770s, or accepting it at least, they were not doing the same in religion. And we might also take the example of Adam Smith, whose important work on The Wealth of Nations was published in 1776, and did, it looks like, actually circulate somewhat widely in the United States in the 1780s. But even here, Smith, who talked about the value of unregulated markets and even unregulated religious markets, did not describe it in ways that were identical with what we now refer to as a free market of faith. For him, there was real value in moderating religious beliefs and religious unity. So the fracturing that we might associate with healthy, competitive economic life is not something that even folks like Adam Smith were comfortable with.
Yeah, let me come back to that, because that gets into your critique of the use of either the metaphor or of the theoretical perspective of rational choice. And I still want to wrestle with this issue of the economic perspective or the economic metaphor, because I think a lot of our listeners might be somewhat unfamiliar with this. In fact, I would assume that many are, because when you talk about economics, even many economists say, well, religion, that's something completely different, and it can't be used economics to explore it. And so I want to press you on one more thing that when I cited your first sentence or two of your paper earlier, you used the word metaphor. to, and you use this quite a bit throughout the paper, to describe both those folks who casually use the phrase free market of religion and then those folks who are using the economic concepts and theory. And again, here, I want to press you on that, given that I'm in that latter group. I'm one of the theoretical economists that deal with this stuff. And I've heard also many people critique the rational choice approach as merely being metaphorical or just the use of analogy. And I want to turn to the definition of the term metaphor. And I looked this up on dictionary.com, since we are an internet podcast site. I figured the internet's a good place to go. And metaphor is defined as a figure of speech in which a term or phrase is applied to something to which it is not literally applicable in order to suggest a resemblance. Now, to me, metaphorical usage might refer to something like, the Research on Religion podcast is a butterfly in the world of educational cyberspace, starting at first as a caterpillar, but on repeated observations becomes a beautiful creature that takes one to new heights of knowledge. Now, that would be a metaphor, because we're not really a butterfly, and we don't go into metamorphosis and be in a cocoon for a while. But we use that metaphorical terminology to really convey a feeling of beauty or wonderment. And I want to contrast this to how folks like myself actually use the term free market or market of religion, and who also see the use of economic logic as a useful analytical framework. Because metaphors do not include causal linkages, whereas the theoretical rational choice explanations and hypotheses tend to do that. And so, to give folks at home a little sense of what I do here, we actually do see a market wherein people exchange their time, effort, and other resources for religious purposes. You know, for instance, you could take a priest or a religious entrepreneur or a group associated with these folks. We recently talked with Matt Boswell on the show about somebody starting up a church. And those religious entrepreneurs or priests might see that there's an unfilled need for spiritual education in a town where there hasn't been a church. And then they endeavor to start up a church by, I don't know, devoting their time and energy in exchange for the time and resources of people who attend their worship services. So there's some kind of exchange going on. I will be your priest and explain to you what's going on in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And you guys come in and participate, help set up chairs, maybe donate in the box when it comes around, the tithing box. And so in that regard, us folks who do this market of religion or the economics of religion, we see suppliers, i.e. specialists who are committed to providing a sermon, music, or counseling. And then we also see consumers, people who would like to enjoy these sermons, the music, and counseling, and that they don't produce this stuff. But, you know, hey, Sunday I want to learn about this book that they call the Bible, and so I will go to this place called the church where there's a supplier doing this. Now, this is an exchange that is going on in a market. The extent to which that is a free market or not a free market depends really on how much a third party, mainly a government, regulates those activities on the suppliers and on the consumer side. And again, just to kind of draw back on this and get your perspective on it, when we talk about economics, most people tend to think it's the study of money. And you're going to study bankers and the stock market and what's happening with inflation. But really, economics is the study of choice under scarcity. And it's how we make trade-offs with our time, our energy, our resources, so that we can satisfy various needs and wants. And as far as I can see, religious actors, and I have to convince my students of this a lot, religious actors such as priests or congregants who go off to Sunday services, they're not immune from the problems of having to make choices under scarcity. And say, when go to church, it's not like, well, I pray for manna from heaven, and all of a sudden, you know, I don't have to worry about funding the building or the, you know, staff that we employ here. You know, so a pastor really has to make choices on whether to use a limited budget to expand his youth ministry, for example, or expand whether he's going to send missionaries abroad. And likewise, worshipers will have to decide whether they want to spend extra time in a weekday Bible study group or whether they want to, I don't know, coach youth basketball or something. And so with this recognition that economic theory applies both to bankers and bishops, you get a whole theoretical collection of tools to explain why some religions flourish or are more efficient at using their resources to attract and retain members, while others are not so good at doing that. And this includes an examination of the degree to which various rules and regulations in the marketplace allow for different religious groups to pursue that goal. So that's the church-state angle of it. So here's, after that long discussion there of explaining my perspective, my general question to you is this. Do you see the economic approach to religion as merely metaphorical, or does it have a more explanatory bent to it?
I'm really ill prepared. That was very instructive, by the way. Thank you. But I'm not in a position to provide a useful critique. I think that there are people out there who can of the rational choice approach or the economic approach to religious matters. There are a couple of points at which I'd say I would have reservations about this approach and the economics approach to religion. One is that these are ultimate matters of truth for people in most cases, and I think that lends a kind of incommensurability to the choices that they're making. Second, I'd say that there is more stickiness in our religious decisions, I think, than there may be in other types of decisions. We are more reluctant to leave one faith tradition. Say we're brought up Protestant and want to move to Catholicism. We're generally more reluctant to do that, I think, than we are in other instances. There's, as the philosopher Michael Sandel puts it, a degree of encumbrance that comes with a religious faith that you don't find with, say, loyalty to Apple or loyalty to Microsoft products or Google products. So I think on those two grounds especially, I might put up a fight, but it would no doubt be a short-lived one because your artillery on this in this instance is much heavier than mine.
Well, let's go ahead.
I'm more concerned with its application to history.
Well, let's go ahead and discuss that, and then let's try to ground this too as well in the historical piece that you do, because we are debating a theoretical concept here: the use of economics to study religion, or at least the use of this free market or marketplace metaphor. But you do discuss this in your realm of expertise, which is colonial America, circa 18th century, early 19th century. Let's go ahead and talk about that, your critiques of this in terms, your critiques of this approach in terms of that. And you mentioned two things that are important here that came out. One is the ultimate cause or the ultimate value that people place on religion. And you say that that's not really that useful of a metaphor, to compare religion to, say, candy bars or cans of soup. And then the other is the stickiness of choice, the encumbrance, as Sandel might have called it. So go ahead and let's talk about this first one, the ultimate cause or the ultimate value of religion.
And I've been evading your question somehow about the relationship between the scientific study, the economic study of religion, to metaphor. And I don't think it's anything like a metaphor. The problem is those of us in the historical profession, journalists, too, tend to rely on this metaphor drawn from the scientific study of religion, I think, and without examining it. And this, again, includes me. I have a tendency to use this free market metaphor despite my reservations about it.
Okay, so I'll give you that. And so we'll just say rational choice explanation instead of metaphor.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think when historians use it, though, they're using it as a metaphor.
Okay. They are
taking these two things, religious life, the intentions of the founders in particular, and economics, and drawing associations between them based on this resemblance, what they see as an equivalent. So I think it's problematic in part because religious liberty meant something different to people in the late 18th century than religious choice might mean to as someone who's using an economic approach to religious matters.
Go ahead and explain that to me, because that was an interesting part of your paper, that religious liberty as used in the late 18th century was different than what we conceive of as religious choice today. And that was something that I really had to wrestle with. I think there's something there, but I want you to explain that a little bit further for me.
Sure. Yeah, well, I have to say, too, that one of the humbling things in looking into this a little more is that I found that there were many more invocations of religious choice by people defending what we generally call religious freedom or religious liberty in the 18th century than I anticipated. Mm-hmm. As I looked back at some things that I'd read carefully in the past, I did find more references to choice, to liberty as a kind of choice than I expected. But what I also found, where I was reinforced in my original conviction that there was something different about them, was that religious choice in the 18th century, when people referred to it, was something that needed to be protected because it was something that bound people to particular communities. That what Madison and Jefferson and any of the other great defenders of religious liberty were up to in the 18th century was the protection of conscience, really, of people worshiping freely, generally privately, in their own places, their own churches, their own synagogues, and not being disturbed by the state. They weren't necessarily defending a person's right to select among differently preferred alternatives. And I'm not, that may be a mischaracterization of the kinds of work you do, but I think that historians don't always make that careful distinction.
And no, that was being...
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's actually a very good point. And I found that subtle point in your argument to be very useful, because when you talked about the founders were thinking about religious liberty in terms of allowing people to protect their own worship practices in their home rather than, you know, okay, we're going to give you a big supermarket of religions and you all go choose from them. That I think is very useful. But there's a little seed in there that I think is... relates to something that we don't quite understand about free market economics or the market or freedom, because that freedom in many ways can be rather scary. And when you open that door of freedom, that allows people to go away from the church that you love. You know, say, you know, you're a congregationalist in Massachusetts, and you say, well, you know, I have the true way. And, oh, yes, I love freedom. I think the government should not impose upon me any certain doctrinal considerations, and so please give me that freedom. That's the religious liberty you're talking about that you think the founders are after. But the other concern is that, well, if you allow freedoms for, I don't know, the Quakers, oh my gosh, that can't happen, because the Quakers, they're wrong. And so freedom can open the door to things that are wrong. And that's, and so when we think about the word choice, we kind of think about the word, well, choices are all equal, and if you take a Snickers bar versus a Three Musketeers, it's the same thing, it's just different. But in that religious area, that kind of choice, people say, oh, no, all of a sudden you become Quakers, and you, I don't know, start eating oatmeal and quaking, and that would not be good. And I think that's what you wrote in your paper there was very useful in making that point on the intent of what the founders were thinking.
Yes, I think that there is a lot of concern that people once allowed these particular liberties will, in fact, make very bad choices.
Right.
But that might not mean embracing Quakerism, which, by the way, or I should say, in the 18th century, I think I've heard you say this before, you know, was a relatively sedate.
It was.
It wasn't the Quakerism of the 17th century, but there were other faiths out there that did look scary. Shakerism looked scary, in particular, to people in the 1780s and 1790s, certain forms of evangelicalism. There are worries, too, that, you know, we haven't come to about what slaves would do if allowed some of these freedoms. So there is a concern among people who want to defend traditional establishments that some people will take advantage of this religious liberty, make bad choices. That sometimes means perhaps turning towards palatable denominations or groups, but it might also mean simply religious indifference, of a turning away from God.
Mm-hmm.
That's the bad choice here that they're talking about. So I think that distinction, too, is worth making.
No, that definitely is the case, and I think that definitely was a palatable fear of people during that time, maybe not of Jefferson or Madison, but certainly of some of the more stronger evangelical or stronger congregationalists that were part of the founding, that, well, if we allow a lot of these freedoms here, then people will devolve to disbelief in that. I should just note as a side note, when we're talking about Quakers, if people haven't heard this, the Quakers, you are correct, by the late 1700s are a relatively sedate religion, what we kind of consider the Quakers to be, or the Society of Friends, as their official name is. But when they originally came about in the 1600s in England, they were called Quakers somewhat disparagingly because they literally quaked. They speaking in tongues, waving of hands, and shouting and running around, oftentimes naked in public squares, and that kind of freaked people out. And you could see that, well, if we allow unencumbered religious liberty, that's what we're going to get a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, and one thing that we certainly see in the 17th and 18th century is a growth in religious diversity. The Quakers are among these groups, the Shakers many evangelical groups helped to essentially fill out the catalog of religious groups that we're now familiar with in every town and city mm-hmm. and colony and then state in early America. And so you do see this great diversification that could, be characterized as a kind of market for people.
Mm-hmm.
So there are strong resemblances here. There's a reason why we go back to this free market metaphor, I think, because it captures something about how life was changing for people in the 18th century. And if they wanted to make religious choices, those may have been available to them in the late 18th century in the way that they weren't back in the 17th century, where you were born into a particular church, and that was pretty much it. There was no expectation of even surveying the different faiths around you, in part because there were no other faiths. By the late 18th century, there are these potential options. It's just mm-hmm. I don't think people are defending the liberty to choose among them so much as they are defending the liberty to worship God as you chose, or as you and your family and your congregation had done for many years.
Yeah, and that is the tension I'm talking about for us, many of us, and still to this day, liberty means, you know, leave me alone.
Yeah.
But boy, I jump at the first chance to regulate somebody else's behavior because, oh, that looks kind of dangerous what they're doing over there. And, you know, they might become some wild, crazy sect or some of the group. And we see that quite a bit today. One of the other things, and you just brought this up in terms of the ultimate nature of religion or what religion actually is, and putting it into the choice framework doesn't necessarily make a lot of sense. And I want to read a passage from your article here and get your statement on this, because this is your second critique of the metaphor or of the causal explanation. You say that for early national Americans, religious affiliation emerged from spiritual and intellectual imperatives that were fundamentally unlike the transitory convictions that prompt people to select specific fashions or motivate them to make everyday purchases of tea, coffee, or flatware. Talk about that a bit.
Well, I think in addition to the range of religious groups that now were in the colonial American and early national environment, you also had an explosion in commerce across the Atlantic Ocean, especially, so that by 1765, 1770, the American colonies were actually consuming a very large proportion of British goods, including sugar, you know, goods that at least were involved in British trade that British merchants had something to do with, sugar, tea, textiles, coffee, a whole potpourri of goods were now available to people in local stores, sometimes on credit, that would not have been available in the past.
Mm-hmm.
So that, in fact, we do see a blossoming of what looks like a free market in the 18th century. And if there was going to be something that would incline people to use that as a metaphor for other things that they liked, like, for instance, religion, that possibility was there. I just don't think it's realized.
Yeah, I would change it a little bit and put a little subtle spin on this and say it wasn't that a free market was emerging, because there, in different spaces, there's degrees of freedom of markets and of exchange in throughout history. You know, going back to Roman era, even to the settlement of agrarian societies, people could exchange things differently. But what's different, and you noted this, is that there's now a market with more stuff. I mean, there's more choices. Before, you could maybe negotiate over a cow or a pig, and that was about it. Now you have a lot of different cuts of meat and the way that it could be prepared with different spices. And so the range of choices is blossoming during this period of time.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's a better way of characterizing.
Yeah. And I want, you know, kind of talk about that, because a lot of people get on my case that when I talk about the economics of religion, they do see me as saying, well, religion or religious choice is just something like buying, you know, as you say, tea, coffee, or flatware here. And being someone who is a practicing Christian himself, although my pastor says I need a lot more practice, I don't take it that way, right? I consider that my choice of a religion, a choice of a faith, of a church that I'm going to belong to or a pastor that I'm going to follow, is actually a pretty important thing. It's not like choosing a candy bar. You know, there are times I go into the store, I'm hungry, I'll grab a Snickers or a Three Musketeers. But then there are other choices that I make that I put in a great deal more of investment. Now, that doesn't necessarily eliminate the choice from it. It might restrict the choice. For example, housing. You know, when I go out and buy a house, I don't buy it like a candy bar. I put in a lot more time and effort saying, do I want to live in that neighborhood? What's my commute going to be like? What are the schools like? So I put a lot more thought into that. And then it's the same, I think, when it comes to religion. It's not to say that I'm taking a very casual or cavalier approach to picking a religion. Oh, I like the paint on that building better than the other. I put some time and investment into it. And then when I make that choice, I tend to stick with it, much like I stick with my house. I don't change houses every week. I don't change automobiles every week. But, you know, candy bars, yeah, I do. That's not important. But, you know, when I stick to a church, I make a strong investment in it and stick with it. And so in that regard, I still think that it could be religion can be seen as something that you exchange. It's not something that's different. I mean, it has different qualities to it, but it still is something that I can make choices about. Now, what are your thoughts on that?
I think that's right. I think, though, it's a matter of degree.
Yeah.
And some choices are much more encumbered than others. Your choice of cereal or candy bars, to use your example, is one that really is fairly inconsequential. There are many, many different choices, and you really are making that choice potentially on a daily or weekly basis. You don't do that with a church. Obviously, you don't do that with a house either. But in most cases, at least, and I'm just mainly talking about the 18th century here, people didn't make a choice of a church, as far as we know.
Yeah.
Now, it could turn up that, or it could turn out, we're going to find a lot of evidence of people actually church hopping in the 18th century, going from one church, one pastor, to another. We don't have that evidence yet. If it does turn up, I think you'd have a stronger case for the notion that the founders, in fact, intended to create something to look like a free market of religion.
Yeah.
But I would say that religion, even today, is more constrained than it was back in the 18th century.
Mm-hmm.
If you looked at the Pew surveys, however, you can see that there's been a change in the last couple decades, especially. I think the last numbers were that something like 44% of Americans changed religious affiliations sometime between their birth and the age of, I don't know, 50 or 60. That's a big number.
Yeah.
I would not expect to see that in the 19th century, and especially in the 18th century.
And I think there's a reason for that, too, is that there really weren't those choices available.
Yep.
Now, first of all, I want to come back and mention, and you said this earlier, that there's a strong cultural component to our faith, our what faith we are in involved in.
And I'll also say, too, that one of the things that's really struck me about those who study religion from a scientific perspective, from a rational choice perspective, is how pious they are. I mean, so I don't mean to diminish whatsoever the faith of those who are looking into this issue from that perspective, and certainly not yours.
Oh, no. I didn't expect that at all. But a lot of people, you know, again, some of my colleagues when I was originally doing this at the outset said, oh, you know, you're studying the economics of religion. You just, you know, this is another thing like candy bars and all those hucksters that, you know, go out and sell religion and just try to make money off it. That's what you're doing. I said, no, that's not what I'm doing. I consider it to be a very important choice. And actually, you know, just coming back to the point I wanted to make here a second ago was, when you talk about the encumbered choice that religion is, you're right about that, because where we get a lot of our preferences for religion comes from our upbringing. It's our culture that we're raised in a Presbyterian household. And so, you know, for 10, 15, 20 years, you know Presbyterianism. And so that becomes the choice or the preference that you have. You know, just much like living in a certain area. I grew up in rural areas. I love living in rural areas. I never want to live in a city. So, you know, that for me becomes part of my culture. And religion is certainly much more encumbered of a choice than that. Nonetheless, when it comes to that colonial period, and you talked about church switching in contemporary times, that church switching was very difficult back then because you didn't have a free market. The market was fairly restricted. You know, take the New England congregational turf during this period of time, is that it was very difficult for anybody to come in, say a Catholic, and say, well, we want to set up a parish here. And, oh boy, there would be a lot of problems in doing that. You'd find it hard to find a place to get a building, and, you know, people would shun you from the community. You weren't allowed to participate in public life. So that choice necessarily wasn't there. So we don't see, I would not expect to see a lot of church switching, in part because there were only one or two faiths to choose from. Now, when you do start to see some diversity come in, and I'm thinking about the first Great Awakening in the middle part of the 18th century, you do see people starting to, you know, show up. Hey, George Whitefield's coming to town. There's a bunch of tents, and wow, he's having a 2-day service out there in old McDonald's pasture. And so let's go see that and sample some of that. People were curious, and they weren't necessarily choosing to give up Christianity wholesale, but they might have been choosing from a different flavor. It's like, well, I like that guy who waves his arms a lot instead of the guy who sits there somber with the, you know, the glasses, bifocals, trying to read from the passage, boring me to death. So I think where a lot of our choice comes from, my reactions to that.
Yeah, sorry, Tony, I lost you for a little bit there on your end. I'm not sure what happened. But yeah, I think that's, from what I gathered from the last few words, yes, I think that really there people aren't able to make choices later on. That is going to affect the way they conceive of religious liberty, I think, and that's part of the reason that, again, the free market metaphor seems compelling to us today, because religious liberty for us today may mean leaving your Catholic family for a Protestant one or Presbyterian one, or from a Catholic, going from a Catholic one to a Jewish one, or vice versa. So I think that. That's right. As choices become more acceptable, they become choices.
Or as choices become cheaper or less costly. Because for me to make a choice of going from being an evangelical Christian to a Jew would involve a lot of relearning everything.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's a costly jump for me. But the choice of going from, let's say, you know, being a non-denominational evangelical to going over to Assemblies of God, well, that's not that big of a jump. And so it's not that costly for me. And the point I was making, and again, you weren't able to hear me for a little bit, is I was arguing that during the 18th century, there weren't that many choices. That if you wanted to go somewhere in Massachusetts, you went to a congregational church. That's it.
That's right. Yeah, I think that's right. And again, that informs the intentions people are going to have when they come up for provisions for religious liberty. You're protecting people to do what they see right by their conscience, to do what they see as their duty, as opposed to freeing them up to make all the choices they want, and as we would today.
Yeah, one of the other critiques you made of the free market approach, or using the term free market, actually is a citation you provided from Mark Knoll. And Mark Knoll writes, and you cite this in your paper, rational choice theory divorces explanation from the lived worlds of the historical participants. Methodists may have flourished in early America because they successfully adapted to a deregulated religious market, but they thought they were winning the souls to Christ, experiencing the witness of the Holy Spirit, correcting the doctrinal mistakes of the Baptist, and preparing converts to serve God, unquote. When I look at that, well, actually, tell me what you think of that statement of Mark Knoll.
I think what he's getting at there is the idea that there's a difference between how we empirically, objectively describe what people are up to and what kinds of constraints they face, what sort of opportunity costs they're enduring, what sorts of preferences they're expressing, and the subjective experience, what people are actually thinking, how they imagine what their ends are in life. And so it may be a slight misconstrual of rational choice theory, but I think he's trying to get at the difference between how we objectively describe these conditions and what people are thinking and dreaming in their own heads.
Well, this turns us to the issue you talk about in your paper about the supply side problems with the economic of religion approach. And by supply side problems, we're talking about how people go out and provide religion or preach religion or proselytize. That we were just talking about the demand side before, the consumers and what their preferences are. But again, there's the folks that go out and preach this stuff. And again, to cite Knoll here, you know, Methodists have flourished in early America because they successfully adapted to a deregulated religious market, but they thought they were winning souls to Christ, experiencing the witness of the Holy Spirit. Now, that, I think, when Knoll talks about that, he's saying, well, you know, people who engage in economic behavior, they sell things. They sell candy bars, or they're bankers, and they do that. But people who go out and our pastors, they're doing something qualitatively different. They're preaching the gospel. They're trying to save souls. And I agree that saving souls is much different than, you know, trying to get somebody to buy candy bars or cans of soup. But yet, I still see the use of basic economic concepts to be useful here, because those folks do have to, quote unquote, sell a religion. They have to convince people. And that's a lot of what selling is about. It's convincing people, hey, you want this can of soup and not that can of soup. And, oh, by the way, aren't you hungry for soup to begin with? You might not have wanted soup. And this, I see this as pastors or ministers doing the same thing, is that, listen, I got this great thing here called the gospel. And boy, you got to hear this because it's the good news. And I need to convince you to adhere to this book and to this interpretation of this book as compared to something else. Thoughts on that?
I think that historians sometimes, as I did, have this, a knee-jerk reaction to the scientific study of religion. So I think what we don't appreciate is that there are ways of talking about religious goods that don't diminish those religious goods.
Yeah.
Simply suggest that they're subject to similar types of incentive structures,
mm-hmm.
Even if the scale is different as other types of goods. So I guess I have to apologize on behalf of historians. We don't always get what you guys are up to.
Yeah. Well, it might be our fault for not explaining it clearly, though.
Well, that could be too. But I think we're also trying to inject more of a subjective experience subjective description into the scientific study of religion, to suggest that maybe not everything can be as easily comprehended as certain models would indicate.
Yeah. No, that's true. And one of the things that is difficult to explain to folks when we talk about this, is even to some ministers, although I've talked to a number of pastors and I explain my approach to say, oh yeah, we have to make all these difficult choices and we're under constraints and scarcity, et cetera, et cetera. But they seem to assume that they're serving a more noble purpose than selling candy bars. And I agree that is the case. I mean, I have no problem with saying that, you know, somebody who's out there preaching the gospel is doing something more fundamentally imbued with purpose and greater philosophical meaning than somebody who is selling candy bars or cans of soup. But nonetheless, they do have to, quote unquote, sell. They have to convince people in order to come to church on Sunday. How are we going to get people to come to church on Sunday when those folks are facing a Seahawks game that's played on the East Coast and that's at 10 o'clock and services are at 9:30 and we'll never get them out of bed because they're going to be watching the game. They have to figure out how to sell, quote unquote, their product or their religious services in a way that makes them more attractive than that other alternative.
Yeah, and I think that makes a certain amount of sense. I think one of the interesting counterintuitive findings, at least that I'm aware of, in the scientific study of religion, it comes from Finke and Stark when they suggest that it's the stricter, more disciplined churches that actually attract people.
Yes.
in the 20th century. And I know that there's been some dispute about this claim more recently, but nonetheless, I think it also suggests that there is something. If in the broad concept of things, the economics of religion makes sense, just drawing an analogy between economics, consumer life, and religion doesn't work. And that's generally the way historians use it. So we would assume that if you provided more goods, more flashing lights for people, they would be drawn to it. But what Finke and Stark are suggesting is that, no, that's not the kind of analogy you need to be using, in fact, or metaphor. In fact, there are other types of incentives and disincentives that people respond to, which are different than the crassest kinds of descriptions of consumer behavior.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. And a lot of people get caught up by criticizing megachurches by saying, well, it is just the flashy lights that attract individuals. But, you know, as we've talked with Mark Vanderer and a few other folks here on the podcast, a lot of times these megachurches actually have pretty deep and intense philosophical or theological grounding to them that you would be surprised. And then, you know, they're doing the fire and brimstone stuff, even though it is, you know, with rock music and PowerPoint presentations.
Yeah.
One other thing, and this is another thing that is interesting for me because I hear a lot of people critiquing this when we talk about market competition of religions. A lot of people tend to conflate it with a zero-sum game of market competition, that I win at the expense of your loss. In your paper, you talk a little bit about evidence that churches would cooperate, and churches of different theological bent. So, you know, you would have Presbyterians and Methodists cooperating on building a church or doing something like that. And I want to get your thoughts on that, because when we hear the word competitive market and we see evidence of cooperation, we tend to not think that it's competitive. Your thoughts on that?
Obviously, there's lots of cooperation in market economy, so I'm not meaning to suggest that. I was, again, taking issue with the loose use of the free market of faith metaphor to characterize what the founders were up to. If you look at James Madison's Federalist Number 10, which a lot of people do disproportionately, it doesn't warrant the attention it gets. It's beautifully written. It's ingenious, but it really wasn't all that influential. But in any case, Madison seems to suggest there that competition between religious groups, like political factions, would lend itself to long-term civil peace.
Yes.
That if you expanded the sphere, if you took in a larger number of groups, a larger number of religious sects, that in the end they would sort of cancel one another out. And that is the model of religious interaction that I think people are using when they employ a free market metaphor. And I what I meant to suggest is that, in fact, what we have in the late 18th century are lots of instances of cooperation between groups which appreciated that they needed to, during the Revolutionary War, in the economic trauma and social trauma that followed, they needed to cooperate with one another to a degree they'd never done before. And that this is something that doesn't fit the free market model as it's used by historians
today. Yeah, maybe we should educate historians on this too, but in a regular kind of narrowly conceived economic market, say for restaurants or, you know, for toy stores, there is a great deal of competition among producers, as the case, but there's also a great deal of cooperation in surprising ways. And, you know, as I was reading through your paper and you were giving instances of cooperation, I said, oh, that actually happens with restaurants too. Even though any given restaurant may be in competition with another restaurant for the dining dollars of consumers, they still belong to the National Restaurant Association, which, you know, works on behalf of all restaurants. And so they have common interest, even though they have competitive desires in that regard. And I have seen that too with churches in our contemporary era, when we would consider there's a lot more church switching that is going on. Again, we recently had a podcast with Matt Boswell talking about a church that he was just starting up, one that I happen to belong to, in our small community. And, you know, he found it pretty amazing that a lot of other churches from in the town or from towns surrounding, you know, came to the assistance of this denomination and say, oh, we'll give you, oh, you guys don't have plates for distributing communion. Well, we'll get you some of those. And, oh, you need some amplifiers or speakers. Yeah, we can borrow you a few that we're not using this week. So there's a great deal of more cooperation. And it's a positive some type of cooperation, where that when we are in competition with one another, but we learn from one another, we're willing to help one another to make everybody better off. And I do agree that that happens more in the religious sphere than it does in, say, restaurants, because you're all serving a greater purpose to, you know, bring people the good news. And that cooperation does occur. And when we use the word competition, it does oftentimes have that negative sum connotation to it, rather than the beneficial aspects that we often do not see.
Yeah, and it's very hard not to use it. I mean, metaphors are powerful. They create associations that we don't expect, which makes them really rich and interesting. But it's just careful, I think, to keep tabs on it. And I struggle myself, because, again, I keep falling back into the same metaphors, whether it's this one or another one. And people have done the same thing with the wall, church of the idea that there's a wall of separation between church and state. It's very easy to derive conclusions once you've established that metaphor that really are unfounded.
Yeah, yeah. Whether it's a very, very thick wall, a heavy wall that many people assume, or if it's a porous wall or something along that lines.
Exactly.
So, let me go ahead, and since you're talking about that, and the wall of separation always comes up when we talk about the intent of the founders. You're somebody who's done a great deal of research in this area, and you've thought about this quite a bit in this paper that you wrote, and was really a reflection upon trying to think about the framers or the founders' intent. We talked about that at the beginning of the podcast, the issue about intent. What do you think, based upon your study of this era, that the founders were intending when it came to laying out the ground rules or the landscape for religion?
That's a really good question, and I'm really still investigating this, as I think a lot of people are, and mine is probably middle position between historians and jurists and legal scholars who argue about these things. As you've probably been well aware of, there was for decades an assumption among jurists that there was this wall of separation that was impermeable between church and state, established with the First Amendment. What the Supreme Court has essentially said over the last few decades is that that's not really the case. In fact, there was a good degree of movement between religion and government this time, and the founders expected to maintain that. I think that that's basically right. It doesn't mean that we can't arrive at a separationist position. And that seems actually to be where separationists are going these days. My co-editor, Chris Grenn, is making the argument in an article that's going to be published soon that the position that we should separate church and state is historically justified, not necessarily by what the founders intended, because they certainly allowed for a certain degree of impermeability, but or permeability, I should say, but in fact by the processes that were at that time being set in motion, which would eventually result in the complete disestablishment of churches and a pretty secure wall between church and state, not an impermeable one, but a fairly secure one at least. So in any case, I think that argument has some merit. I'm not sure if Chris Grenda is writing about separationists believes that it does, but I think that the idea that the founders were in the process, and those who followed them were in the process of establishing some degree, at least, of separation between church and state, I think that's about right. But at the founding itself, in 1787, 1791, people would have allowed for more religion and government interaction than most people, I think, would be comfortable with today.
Yeah, you finish off your paper, I think, with a very interesting case about the, instead of using economics as an analogy, you talk about politics as an alternative analogy for understanding the relationship between church and state at this time and what the founders were thinking. So explain that a little bit.
Well, I wanted to suggest that, first of all, there was a good alternative to the market when comparing religious life in the late 18th century to some other phenomenon that mattered to people. And what I wanted to suggest there is, as historians have long done, that there were connections between the way people ordered their church lives and their religious lives more generally and the way they ordered their political lives. Nathan Hatch, a couple decades ago, made the argument that what we see in the early 19th century is the democratization of American Christianity, that people turn towards their pastors, expect them to behave as their Republican politicians, small R Republican politicians did, to make compelling cases abide by an egalitarian ethos, to treat members of the congregation in a fair and equal manner. In the early 19th century, I think what we're seeing is partly the reflection of what was in the Declaration of Independence, to a lesser degree what was in the Constitution, and the idea that everybody was equal, and at least all white people at the time, were equal. That same comparison between Republican politics and religion has been made by another scholar named Patricia Bonham, and she says even as far back as the colonial period, people were making connections between Republican government and religious government. In any case, that's a long way of saying that there were plenty of other sorts of resemblances that people saw at the time between other forms of association, between other kinds of organization, between other relationships other sorts of relationships between people, that the founders might have had in mind when framing religious provisions.
I think that's true, and I like that how you close the paper with that, because politics, the way one chooses their political affiliations or their general political ideology, has much in common with the way we choose our big theological ideas about the creator and the supernatural, etc. So there's, you know, you have that same kind of, as we were talking about before, that same kind of encumbered choice that has a great deal of impact to it because it's very important. And on the other hand, it is encumbered in that it's how we grew up and how we were enculturated with the different things. The one thing that I would say, though, in closing this, and as I read your paper, I said, well, you know, I love that analysis of, or the analogy of, the democratization of Christianity and politics as being a good analogy here. But as I thought about that, you know, democracy is really market types of behavior being applied to the political realm, whereas previously you had a central king that made all the decisions. What happens now is that you allow citizens greater sovereignty. You allow citizens greater choice in how they construct the rules that govern them. And as is the case in a market where not citizens are sovereign, but consumers are sovereign. They have much more choice and much more degrees of freedom in choosing, well, I want that product instead of that product. So I think the two in many ways might be similar. Your thoughts?
I think that's right, although I'd say that people appreciate that the choice of governments that they make, the choice of political leaders, is a grave decision that's going to affect every single aspect of their life,
right,
as with a religious decision.
Yes.
It is a choice with a lasting effect in a way that the choice of most consumer goods does not have. So I think that maybe just a matter of scale or degree, but nonetheless there's an important distinction there to be made.
I think that is true. Well, that about wraps up our time here. I know that you've been writing some other interesting material on violence and religion in the early colonial times, or I should say the later colonial times, and we're going to have to check back on you on that. So it would be okay to have you back on the show pretty soon?
Well, I'd love to talk to you about that or anything else, including the Fate of Your Fantasy team next year, Tony.
Okay, yeah, I think I'm going to have to call you up for advice on that because it didn't turn out for me.
I wouldn't do that, but it'd still be fun to talk about.
Okay, well, that sounds good. Well, so, Chris, I want to thank you for being on our show, Research on Religion.
Well, thanks, Tony. It's a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.